All right. We'll let the little ones file out and the rest of us get our Bibles open to Numbers. Chapter 33 is where we're going to be tonight. Looking forward to studying that with you. We are very nearly at the end. If you can imagine being ready to move on somewhere else, imagine being Israel on the borders of on the banks of the Jordan, getting ready to hopefully go and be somewhere else finally. It's a place that's been talked about for generations, and finally they are on the doorstep. As we get to the doorstep of Canaan, we need to recognize that several things are going to be taken care of before they get there. One author wrote on this section, "For something as important as finally crossing over into the promised land, they're not going to do this haphazardly. They're not just going to run into Canaan and figure it out when they get there. There's going to be lots of planning involved. Things like boundaries, things like who gets what piece of land, things like who are the heads of tribes and so on. All those things need to be taken care of. And as you would expect, this is a real life event, and this is the type of thing we would do in real life. We'd be worried about things like borders. We'd be worried about things like who's in charge of each tribe. We would want to know where we came from. And we would want a way to remember it. And that's what we find in Numbers chapter 33. A way for Israel to start remembering where they had been. Here is where we are again in the book. We have but one more class together. Next Wednesday night we'll do the last two chapters of the book, chapters 36, 37. And then we will take basically a two-month break from our study, and we'll have our summer series on basically the resurrection. Looking forward to having all of us here. We can get our numbers back on Wednesday night and be ready to get some really good edification from the men that are coming. I have every confidence in the ones I've, not because I picked them, but I've heard what they do. And I'm very confident they'll be able to help us. And so I want to make sure that we're doing our best to be here and profit from that. Let's get into Numbers 33. This is one of those chapters where, again, we will not read the chapter in its entirety, much like the list of names earlier when we dealt with the census. This is another place where it's very formulaic. It's a lot of strange place names. But here is the basic summary. Numbers 33, beginning there in verse 1. You see in these four verses, beginning in verse 1, these are the stages of the people of Israel when they went out of the land of Egypt by their companies under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Moses wrote down their starting places stage by stage by command of the Lord, and these are their stages according to their starting places. They set out from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after the Passover, the people of Israel went out triumphantly in the sight of all the Egyptians. While the Egyptians were burying their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them, on their gods also the Lord executed judgments. Beginning from that point, moving forward through the chapter, you have the same sort of repeated pattern in what is said, with very little variation. You have essentially the people of Israel set out from a certain place, and then they camped at a certain place. And then they set out from that place and they camped at another place. And you get a few little details mixed in, as in maybe how long they stayed there. Down in verse 9, what was there where they camped? In that case, 12 springs of water and some palm trees. Verse 14, Rephidim, a little reference to what happened there. There was no water to drink. They make it to the wilderness of Sinai. And again, very few little details moving along. Where is there a break in the action? What's the next break in that chapter? Where sort of the pattern breaks from they set out and camped at, fill in the blank.
Well, verse 38, you have reference to the death of
Okay. So from 5 to 37, you have basically from Ramses, the Egyptian city where they left, to Mount Hor, where Aaron dies. And in 38, you see that's the first break in the action. It says there, Aaron the priest went up Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the people of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt on the first day of the fifth month. And Aaron was 123 years old when he died on Mount Hor. Would you say that is a positive or a negative sort of fact? As you're just reading through this. It's negative because, like you said, he doesn't get to see Canaan. This is, and I know it's obvious, but this is the same Aaron from verse 1 who left Egypt with Moses, leading the people of Israel. And so as we're reading this itinerary, maybe, or it's not a complete itinerary, and we'll talk about why in a minute, but as we're reading through this, and all of a sudden it stops to say, Aaron died on Mount Hor. He didn't make it. But, yes, ma'am. Nope, go ahead. You're fine. I'm glad you mentioned that. What's left out of the itinerary is what happened, right? We don't get the history of what happened with the spies going in and God saying that this generation won't go into the land, and we don't hear about Moses. But in this one little blurb about Aaron, you get a detail about something that happened to a lot of Israelites. Most of them didn't make it. And you see that with Aaron. Maybe it would have been a mental reminder. Paired with that negative note, you have a positive note in verse 40. Is this doing what I want it to do? Hey, look at that. What's the positive note in verse 40?
Israelites are coming to the land of promise.
Yeah. This is the ancient Near Eastern version of the redcoats are coming, right? This is the Canaanite king goes, uh-oh, they're on their way. He does what the city of Jericho is going to do later when we get to Joshua. In like 2025, whenever we make it there. But you have a positive note. You have a negative note about Aaron, and you have a positive note about this Canaanite king who sees them coming. Sort of a look forward to what to expect. And in the rest of the chapter, it goes back to its same pattern, and it finishes where? In verse 49.
Banks
of the Jordan. Exactly where we were at back when we started talking about Balaam and King Moab and the Moabite king, Balak. They've been here, it seems like, for a while in the text, but you got to remember, it's not all narrative. There's a lot of things mixed in here, things that need to be taken care of before they cross over. Okay, in reality, from the time they arrive at the Jordan to the time they cross over is not that big of a time. It's definitely not 40 years. From when they get to the Jordan to when they cross over. It feels like a long time because in your Bible, there's a whole lot of text between those two events, right? You have the entire book of Deuteronomy, the rest of the book of Numbers. Finally, we get to cross over in Joshua's, early chapters of Joshua. So it's going to feel like that, but in reality, it's not that long. But verse 50, the pattern breaks again, and so we want to notice it. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab, by the Jordan at Jericho. That's at least the third time we have reference to the city of Jericho in Numbers. Saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you pass over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, what are they to do with the inhabitants? What are the instructions?
Drive them all out.
Drive them out. Run them off. Enslave the peoples? No. Enter into treaties with the peoples? No. Drive off means run off, right? You drive them out, literally make them go somewhere else. Conquer them, destroy them, utterly. But that's not all. It was more than just the people. What else is there? There's three verbs that begin with a D in this section. There's drive off, there's destroy, and there's one more.
Demolish.
I like that. That preaches because you got three of them, right? Anything with threes, it preaches. This is what they were supposed to do. In short, drive off, destroy, demolish. Right? Nothing was supposed to be left of the people or their religion. Religions, plural. Whatever they worshipped. It was idolatry as a whole, but that was the idea. Then they take the land in verse 53, possess it and settle it. And it's going to be settled by lot, verse 54. God would do the choosing. It would so happen that large tribes would get large inheritances, small tribes, small inheritances, and so on. Verse 55, if they did not do this, then what? If you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then those of them whom you let remain shall be as barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. That doesn't sound pleasant, and it wasn't. It wound up not being that way. They shall trouble you in the land where you dwell. Verse 56 is ominous, isn't it? I will do to you as I thought to do to them. What was supposed to happen to them is obliterated, so they need to avoid that at all costs. Moving on to 54, or sorry, rather 34. No, actually, I don't want to do that yet. I want to come back. A couple of the authors that I was looking at preparing for the material, I always wonder in these big long lists of things. We like to skip over the lists. Brent. Yes, sir. I think that's true.
That's not the pattern they follow. But I think that if they would have stuck through with that, they would have a whole lot less trouble too.
Yeah, they each sort of went their own way and sort of conquered their own land, right? Kind of individually. Judges 1 gives you that impression. Certainly they were supposed to go and kind of do all of it and then go home. There was some of that. At the end of Joshua, there is a moment where Joshua sort of sends home everybody. But they were definitely splintered before that. They had one big break already, you remember. Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh decided they wanted land on the wrong side of the river. And so rather than taking their entire army into Canaan and helping out, they sent basically a representative force, not even a third of their full strength, over to help out. With this big long list of names, I'm always looking for ways to organize it and see how it was meant to be. This was there for a reason. This is part of their law. This is part of what they were supposed to know. And you always want to ask why. Turns out, it looks like there's a pattern in this. It's not obvious from looking at it, and I've read it over and over, and until I read this, I didn't realize there was a pattern. It seems like this chapter set up in a way that can be memorized easily. When you want to memorize something, you give it the same number of things, right? You get groups of 5, groups of 10, however. Here's one way that this seems to have been organized. 6 groups of 7 is what it looks like. Each of the groups has 7 individual campsites in it. You can go through and you can count. From Ramses to the Dead Sea, it seems like there's 7. In the wildernesses of Sinai, Sin, and Paran, there were 7. You have that spies sent to Canaan or sent from Paran and coming back to Kadesh. There's 7 of them. Anyway, 6 groups of 7. What's interesting about this is if you take the end of the chapter as the 7th book or as the 7th group, it's kind of the completion of the journey, isn't it? 7 stages with 7 stops in all but the last one. And in the last one, this is when they actually get to go in. Right? Instructions on how to go in and conquer the land. It's an interesting thing. One reason for doing this is for memorization purposes. I'll put this back up in a second, or I can send it to whoever would like to have it. One reason why it's thought that this is in a pattern is not all the names are here. Numbers 35 doesn't contain every single solitary campsite. As you go through the book of Numbers, there are a few missing. Most of them are missing from chapter 21, 12 through 20. There's about 4 or 5 names that are left out of this particular list. This list wouldn't have existed as a legally binding history of Israel, where they went through the wilderness. This was supposed to be a teaching tool and a learning tool, something to help them remember what they did, long, long ago. Right? You remember most Israelites didn't possess a Bible. None of them actually possessed the entire thing. So they would have needed a way to memorize it. I put a note to Matthew chapter 1 also. Matthew chapter 1 is set up like that too with Jesus' genealogy. Not every name is listed in Matthew 1. But there's three groups of 14, which is a significant number to them. But anyway, just roll that around and see what you think about it. All right. Numbers 30, well, we'll get there in a minute. Numbers 34, the boundaries of the nation of Israel. You know, scintillating material, reading material. This is the type of thing you read when you want to go to sleep, right? You know, your south side shall be from the wilderness of Zin alongside Edom, and your southern, you know, you get the idea. But what's really important is that God clearly indicates where they are supposed to be. Okay, here are your borders. This is where I expect you to go. It's very similar to the description given in Ezekiel 47. God is recounting kind of the image of the perfect nation. He gives the instruction, the borders again, and it's very similar to these. As they say, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. So let's look at some pictures. This is probably my absolute favorite picture of Israel, that part of the world. It's an aerial shot, obviously, not, you know, someone didn't stand on the ground and do it. But you can pick out a couple of key details. You can see down here, what would this be down in this area? Yeah, the Dead Sea. Okay, and so that would mean up here, Sea of Galilee, right? From Jesus' life, he crossed. He like spider webs across the Sea of Galilee, like 28 times or something in the book. Always crossing the sea. Well, that blue line between them, Jordan River. Over here, the Mediterranean. When we compare this map to the next one, you'll see it has kind of this swoop, and then there's a little hook right here. You can see that in the next one too. Right. This is the more traditional one that you're normally used to seeing. I know the names are really small. Somebody attempted to go through and put all of the place names from Canaan before Joshua shows up. One issue with a map like this, on a lot of the sites, we're not exactly sure where the cities were. It's been so long ago, and they've changed names so many times, it's really hard to nail down. The most notorious place to nail down is Sinai. Where is Mount Sinai? There have been upwards of 20 different suggested places. Turns out there's a whole lot of mountains down here to pick from. And which one exactly is it, we don't know for sure. Which, if you think about it, that's probably a good thing. If we knew precisely where Mount Sinai was, what would happen?
Build shrines.
It would happen exactly what happened in Jerusalem. They built a temple on top of it, right? And it would be worshipped and so on. Probably a good thing. We don't know where exactly that is. Same for the Ark of the Covenant. Same for, you know, a lot of things. Yes, sir?
Just very coincidentally, I just looked at channels last night. And on the Discovery Channel, there was a whole discussion about where was Sinai. And there's one place that the scholars believe might be it because there was an early temple building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With an engraved picture of Moses.
Oh, maybe a relief, you know, a Polaroid from back when. It'd be nice if he wrote on a tree somewhere Moses was here, you know, but trees, you know, grow up and get old. But that's what we would have did, you know, carved a, never mind. But anyway, one reason I love this picture, it's a real place. And I know some of you have been there. I want to go there one day. But if you've never been, like me, sometimes it's hard to think about this place as an actual place with dirt and grass and people, you know. It's just, this actually exists. I know it sounds strange, but it does. This actually is in the news right now, as it is every few months, for whatever reason. Here is a map. The names are going to be too small, but just notice the lines. The red line is roughly where the numbers 34 borders are, based on the descriptions we see here in the chapter. The blue line is the Ezekiel 47 version. You can see they're very simple. Very, very, very close to one another. Even being hundreds of years apart,
still roughly, they do about where it was supposed to be. Of course, the nation of Israel would actually exceed these bounds at some point. Do you know when that would be? When would it be bigger than this? David and Solomon, right? Their reign, before the split and all the bad things start happening, right? When David and Solomon come to power, Solomon in particular, their influence would be at its greatest. But this is the version of it that at least is Numbers 34 describes. And there's a few details here. You can see Edom's down here at the bottom. You remember that's the land Israel couldn't walk through, and God told them to leave them alone, but you know they're related. And then up here where Gilead is where the disgruntled 2.5 tribes are going to take. That looks better on my computer than it does here. Here's roughly, and you've probably seen some version of this before, where the tribes were. Okay, roughly. Again, we're at the mercy of ancient place names. So getting down to, you know, the square foot of who had what is a little difficult. But we know roughly where they were supposed to be. Did you have a comment? True. That's a very good point. Folks would read the River of Egypt and think, oh, it's the Nile, and think, well, why don't they control all the way down to, you know, it didn't. It went, where was it? Yeah, so somewhere roughly, you can actually see it on this map. There's a little River of Egypt note right there, just south of Gaza, south and west. So yeah, they were supposed to control from that to, you know, way on up there. Okay, but again, the big details here, notice that Reuben and Gad and Manasseh, or at least half of them, are on the wrong side of the river. Okay. When the nation starts going through its difficulties after Solomon's reign, they go first. They're the first ones to fall, almost immediately. Because you remember after Solomon, you have to divide, Rehoboam, Jeroboam, and that's when things all start to careen downhill. For the nation. Philip mentioned this to me, it's been a couple, 3 weeks ago, but about Simeon, right? Simeon and Levi, you remember at the end of Genesis, because of what they did in the matter of Dinah, their sister, and the Shechem, or Shechem, right? They were told that they would be dispersed throughout Israel by Jacob. That's one of the curses or blessings, part of the blessing he's given before he dies. You'll notice on the map who is missing. Whose name isn't up there at all?
Levi.
All right. And then Simeon would wind up being basically the donut hole of Judah. And what happens to a donut hole? It gets eaten. Right, you eat them, and it's gone. They would disperse. By the time of Jesus, though, they still knew who they were as tribespeople. Okay, you remember there's a descendant from Simeon who actually sees the infant Jesus in the temple. So they know who they are. They're just going to be not really having a definite land. True. Yeah. It would be like a bunch of dots just all over the place. Right. You had the cities of refuge, three on either side of the river, plus the plain Levite cities. You know, and there were dozens of those mixed all throughout there. But anyway, this puts a place with a text, helps us sort of wrap our mind around it. Okay, Numbers 34:16. You have a list of the chiefs who are going to be the ones, they're going to help in this process of dividing up the promised land. This makes a lot of sense. If you're trying to divide up 2 million plus people, you don't want them all standing around getting announcements. You pick representatives, and then they go to where, you know, Eleazar and Aaron and later Joshua, and then they work out who goes where. And so you see a list here of all of those individuals. Most of them, we probably won't hear much of them again, except for one. Caleb. Caleb is special because he's the only one from the original list, right? In the early chapter, I think it's Numbers 1, actually. You have a list of the tribes, the heads of tribes. This is Numbers 1 and verse 15. When they actually take their census of who can go to war. I'm sorry, Numbers 1 and verse 5. I can't talk tonight. Numbers 1 and verse 5, you have a list of chiefs of tribes. From 5 down through 16 of chapter 1. The only one that's still around is Caleb. All the rest of these are replacements. They're actually going to get to cross the river and go into the land of Canaan. All right? Yes, sir.
Just a wild thought.
Well, those are the best.
When we were looking at the map, I was trying to put some context in my head. I don't have any way to confirm this, too. Just a quick search. That entire piece of land is only slightly larger than our state of New Jersey.
Yeah, that's the thing that struck me about this picture.
Yeah.
As I said, they got an aerial shot of the whole thing. You know, imagine someone getting an aerial shot of Mississippi. I mean, you'd have to be in space. I mean, you'd have to be or very nearly up there, right? You'd have to be a long way up. But
with the topography there, you can also understand how they go up to Jerusalem.
Yep. All the repeated references going up to Jerusalem, going down to, you know, to the cities on the coast and so on. We think of go up and go down as go north and go south, where they thought it as go up the mountain or down it, you know. And that's how they reckoned a lot of it. One thing that's nice to notice too, the promised land isn't a barren wilderness. I mean, it's green. You know, there's flowers and trees and so on. It's not Mississippi, but it's not the Sahara either. This would be a land of very profitable land, agriculturally speaking, trade, right? There's a reason why everything has to go through here. You have the Mediterranean on one side, and you do actually have barren wilderness nothing over here. And the only way to go from north to south in that part of the world is right through there. Winds up being a trade route. It's been that way for a long, 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 long time. Damascus city in Syria has been around some 6,000 or 7,000 years, right, since it was created. So very, very, very old part of the world as far as our reckoning with it. Anyway, anything else struck you as you went through the text? Anything else you saw or any questions you had? What did you see as you went through?
First thing I thought of, Moses kept the journal. First thing I thought of. Is that the beginning of
doctrine? Sort of. So, why did he do it?
Well, God told him to, number one. But he did it in a way that God wanted it to be done also. But he did keep one. He gave it. He gave us that in this book so that those people of Israel would know the journeys that their forefathers had already been through. Mm-hmm.
This is a strong argument for Moses' authorship of the book. Because it literally says, God told him to write it down. And so he did. And he wrote down everywhere that they were, and he would have recorded the rest as well. So definitely, that's definitely one big detail you want to notice in the first chapter 33. Okay? What else did you... Yes, ma'am. That's an excellent point. Like she mentioned, the place names carried meaning with them, you know, and it would have reminded them of bits of the story. Again, this was set up as a memorization tool, not just, okay, let's remember the 42 names, but that it told a story as you went along. It was literally a way to remember the trip. I haven't read a good argument for why. That's a good question. Like why such or some are such bigger than others. some of it, I think, came down to the individual tribes and what they actually conquered. Right? What they were given didn't wind up being what they actually possessed. You know, if they would have possessed what they were given, it would look probably very different. But Judges 1, Judges 1 in the beginning of chapter 2, this tribe didn't conquer this land, this tribe didn't conquer this land, and they are all listed except for Issachar. Why were they left out? I don't know, but absolutely. What else did you see? Yes, sir. You're next, and then you're next.
It just made me think of that comment where people are, this being a learning tool, not only do the names of the places have a meaning, but I forget, these people that are going into the Promised Land have all lost family. And they think of, or I would imagine they think of, we lost mother, we lost father, we lost uncle at this place, at this place, at this place. And it kind of goes through along with that memory of where things happened.
Yeah. This was a real journey, and it wasn't easy. And there's a reference in there to Aaron, I think, to remind them, you know, not everybody made it, and it took a really long time. You know, it took some 39 years longer than it should have because of the incident with the spies. Excellent. Couple things. We're running low on time, but I just realized this today. When you and I started studying and we got to the Exodus, that was the last class we had before COVID sort of cut off meeting in person. It was Exodus 13 and 14. It was March the 11th of 2020. And here we are meeting together, going literally back over the summary of where we left off. It's been a great while, but just, it's not a biblical fact, it's just a fun fact. Just so happened we were studying tonight. Their memorization began where ours sort of stopped. I think you had a comment, and I think you had one too, right? Did you have a comment?
I was going to mention that the further you go north in Israel, the better the land is. In the northern part of it, you've got Mount Hermon, and you've got the rains and the water that comes through there. You've got the River Jordan, and so it's very fertile up there. Pretty much anything there. The further south you get, the worse it is. It's dry and arid. So I would think that those northern tribes were more farmers, and then Judah and the other ones were more herdsmen, because when you get down to Jerusalem and you go down to Beersheba and those places south of there, it's I would call it desolate. You know, you couldn't grow anything like what you can up in the north. So perhaps the tribe were divided up based upon whether they were going to be agricultural people or whether they were going to be merchants. You drive
interesting
from
Jerusalem
to Jericho today, you'll see when you're going down that 5,000 feet of elevation, you'll still see nomadic people out there with their animals and things like that. They're in land that you couldn't do anything with. I mean, it's just grown up. And then you got the Dead Sea there, so there's not that much.
There's nothing growing in there. Except for a little bitty shrimp. Yes, sir. They began just to be known as Judah because that was, like you mentioned, that was their affiliation. And then the northern tribes, even in a sense, not assimilated, but they all became known by one tribe, right?
And you can see that in the prophets. They begin to be called Ephraim several times. And it's not just Ephraim. It's a reference to all of northern Israel. They were sort of the ringleaders of that. But a couple things I want to make sure. Just notice that this chapter also, 34, is a these two chapters are a transition. They begin with Moses and Aaron, and they end with Eleazar and Joshua. Okay, so you have just a little bit of a reference there to a transition. God, he told Moses to record this because he wanted his people to remember it. And this wasn't just Moses' homework. You know, this was their culture. This was how they came to be a people. We've been reading about how they became more than just the family of Jacob. It's now they're a nation. This is their origin story in a lot of ways. This journey, this exodus, and all the way to Canaan, it's how they began. Yeah. Yes, sir.
It's also doubtful that Moses was out of the Egyptian system. Because he would have been equipped to be able to do that. And he understood all these systems of setting up archiving things and keeping records and being very precise.
That's an excellent point. I heard one person say he was the perfect man for the job because, one, he was educated, you know, for 40 years, and then he went in the wilderness and led sheep around for 40 years. So he knew how to do both. By the time God calls on him when he's around 80 years old, but definitely you can see evidence of his education here with this, and God using that for his purpose. Chapter 33 begins and ends with victory. That's exactly how the chapter begins. It begins with a story of God being victorious. When Israel leaves stage by stage, and they leave in chapter 33 and verse 3, they went out triumphantly in the sight of the Egyptians while the Egyptians are burying their firstborn. And God has executed judgments against the gods of their land. That's a victory statement. You know, that's the first big key pivotal battle. And 33 ends the same way. It ends with talking about how they're going to be victorious, with a warning at the end, but it's still a reference to victory. The final stage of their journey is going to be victory. We haven't spoken so much to... Is that the final? Yeah, it looks like it, or it's close. Some applications we can make, and there were a couple that I wanted to make sure we saw. We just sang a song a few minutes ago, I Am Bound for the Promised Land. Well, none of us are in Israel, at least not at the moment. We're not re-walking the Exodus, but we still sing about us being in the Promised Land. We look at our walk with Christ as an Exodus, as a trip across the wilderness. We too are looking forward for a Promised Land. We've been liberated by means of water, and you know we've talked about that some before too. We view our walk the way they would have seen theirs. We're being led by our Moses, the one whom Moses said in Deuteronomy 18:19, you know, there will be a prophet like me and you got to listen to him. That's Jesus. We're following our own Moses across the wilderness. It begins with victory and it ends with victory. Okay, I love the way this is described, and this will be our last point this evening because of time. 1 Corinthians 15 is a familiar passage. You know, oh death, where is your sting? That sort of thing. God gives us the victory. 1 John 5 talks about our victory as something that has been accomplished. And you can see we're going to have some similarities with Israel. They began with victory and they're going to end with victory. Ours is the same way. 1 John 5 and verse 4, John writes, "For everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God?" That's a statement of victory, and not pending victory or future looking, although there is an aspect of that. It's we are victorious now. We've been forgiven. We can look forward to the hope of the resurrection, just like Israel walked out of Egypt looking forward to a hope for a better thing. They have experienced victory already. Helpful to remember as Christians, we're on the winning side. been victorious, and we look forward to even the greater fulfillment of that victory. Right? The victory that comes through Christ. And again, 1 Corinthians 15, towards the end of that chapter, gives us that pretty good. All right. Thank you guys for studying along with us tonight. I think the little kids aren't back yet, so we'll take a brief pause, and then we'll have our invitation in just a moment. Hopefully they'll be on their way here shortly.